Welcome to Streaming Thoughts, where we stream our thoughts on movies, TV, and all things nerdy. I am Daniel.
And I am Nathan.
And welcome to our podcast. So Nathan, what is in the news docket today?
Oh, Dan, you know, we haven't done a Netflix watch party in a while, and I really think we should.
Yes, let's do it. I'm down for that.
Coming up in March, there's a new Netflix original anime being released.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know which one it is?
A Netflix original anime? No, I haven't heard.
Pacific Rim, The Black.
What? Okay, hold on.
We have to watch this.
Yes, but do we know if Guillermo del Toro was involved in this project, yes or no?
I do not. I just saw it listed on the upcoming list of movies, and I'm like, I'm sold. I'm just Pacific Rim, anime style. I'm sold. I'm there. Let's do this.
Yes. But if Guillermo del Toro is involved in this project, that would be so cool. And I would not doubt that Guillermo del Toro will be involved in this because Guillermo del Toro also loves anime. I mean, he's stated in previous times that Akira is one of his favorite films.
Nice. Golden Globes just recently dropped all of their nominations for 2021 of movies released in 2020. Based on our recording schedule, I'm thinking by the time this comes out, they will have announced the winners. So let's do some Golden Globe 2021 predictions.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm totally down for that. I mean, this is quite an interesting year, obviously, for the Golden Globes or any award ceremonies with film, right? Just because of a little thing called COVID-19 that kind of wrecked the theater and the movie releases and all kinds of stuff for 2020 and, you know, this early part of 2021. So this is a very, very different Golden Globes for sure. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that if you would have told me what would have ended up in the Golden Globes in early in 2020, I would have given you a whole different list of movies.
Well, I mean, even things like Hamilton, I don't think that would normally be open for Golden Globes, but they kind of adjusted the requirements and
here it is.
It's under the category for best
musical comedy. Yeah. And there is also another one in the musical comedy category, film that we did talk about. Do you know which one that is?
Palm Springs.
Yeah.
So on prediction, I'm thinking there's one that's obviously probably going to win over the other one there.
You think Hamilton is going to win this category?
Hamilton is already well established as being very critically acclaimed. I honestly would be shocked if Palm Springs came out ahead of Hamilton or any of the other ones listed, really.
Yeah, to be honest, like I really haven't seen the Prom music or Borat subsequent movie film, although I do have plans to see Hamilton. Probably be the only time that a musical film is something that I would enjoy. I don't like musicals. Again, I just want that record to be reflected here. Don't like musicals.
I know.
But I mean, other than that, I think that Hamilton, you know, it's such a part of the culture now, right, that I feel like I would imagine that that's going to take the win in this category.
Similarly, for the best actor, I'm thinking Lin-Manuel Miranda for Hamilton is going to take it as well.
Yeah, are you talking about for best actor?
Best actor for musical and comedy, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Definitely. I totally agree with you, I think. I mean, obviously, Andy Samberg and Sacha Baron Cohen are other two people that also have really good acting chops and give good performances. I mean, these guys are seasoned, right? I mean, all of these guys are seasoned, but this is a whole different list of nominees, right? Like, on movies that, again, like, I just didn't expect these movies to show up for these. Now, what did you think about the nomination for the late Chadwick Boseman for the Ma Rainey's Black Bottom movie?
Yeah, I was looking at that, and I know Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is one that we had discussed potentially watching for the podcast, and I still think it will be worth checking out, but overall, I'm thinking Chadwick Boseman has picking up the posthumous Golden Globe for his production, just based on his nomination and who else is up there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he is standing next to Gary Oldman and Anthony Hopkins, right, which are really seasoned actors. I'm with you. I think Chadwick is going to be, if I were to predict, I would say Chadwick is going to be the winner for this. Now, there's other folks here that I thought were really interesting that ended up showing up, like as far as like animated films, for example. Another surprise is on that. Another movie that we got a chance to talk about ended up showing up in the animated categories.
Obviously, we discussed Onward, and I saw Soul, which is a good movie, but I don't think it's the best on the category. The one that, just based off of the critic reception to it and trailers, that unfortunately I have not yet been able to see, but I really want to see it, Wolfwalkers.
Yeah, it looks really interesting, the animation for this.
That looks so amazing, just the stylized animation, the story, it feels like it's going to have like a very heartfelt connection with the audience.
Yeah.
I so want to see that movie. Unfortunately, at the moment, it's only available on Apple TV, which I do not have.
Only on Apple TV? Oh, okay. Gotcha. Oh, that's a bummer because, yes, I also don't have that. And I have no intentions of getting into more streaming platforms, you know, like just not going to do it.
It's the downside of having so many streaming platforms. And I'm so hoping that at some point, Wolfwalkers looks so good. And
yeah,
well, as I certainly enjoyed Soul, I enjoyed Onward. The critical responses that I'm seeing, I'm kind of leaning that Wolfwalkers is going to have the, you know, takeaway on this one.
Yeah, I think so.
If it ever comes out on DVD, we are totally reviewing that one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm totally down for it. It looks really cool. Now, best score. That's another category I thought was interesting. We have The Midnight Sky, Tenet, and Soul in here for best score for motion picture, which I think it's going to be a tough fight. Although I feel like I really wasn't as impressed by the score of The Midnight Sky, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, not compared to Tenet. I haven't seen Soul, but I heard that the score for Soul is one of the best scores out there. Like, John Batiste just does amazing work in there.
The soul and heart of music was so center stage for Soul that it had an amazing musical performance throughout the whole thing, from the jazz and just this trying to show the audience this is what music is about. This it's a spark of the love of the music. I think that would have a very good chance of picking that up.
Yeah.
And that's just based off of what I've seen in Tenet and Midnight Sky. I have not seen News of the World or Mank, so I'm not really sure how those play up against Soul, but I'm leaning towards Soul on this one.
Absolutely. I'm going to go with you on that. As much as I love Tenet, I feel like the impact of how people have described Soul's score has been, people have said that people who don't listen to music scores, who have actually started listening to the Soul music score because it's that good. So, I mean, I haven't seen the movie. I definitely have plans to see it soon because I think this is a great film. But, you know, I think Tenet might be the number two pick. If it's not Soul, I think it's going to be Tenet. So,
all right.
And that means that Ludwig Göransson would bring it again, another Golden Globe. Now, the best drama series and familiar series is in there, right?
Oh, man, The Mandalorian. It's so amazing, actually, if you think about it. If I went back 10 years and said, oh, a Star Wars sci-fi TV show is going to be up for a best drama series, I'd be like, no, it won't.
Yeah, right? Exactly. But it's such a great compliment, right? You know, I think in the industry, right, it's such a great recognition for a Star Wars property. And I think that for us nerds, it's a win that a bunch of old people who had this really archaic views of film and television were like, yeah, let's give one of these to a Star Wars series.
Now, I've also seen Ratched, and I did enjoy that, but it was enjoyable in the sense that if you are a fan of the source material that they are basing it off of, I don't really see it winning the best drama. The one that I think is going to have the best chance of winning is The Crown.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously going to pick a drama series, right, that's more drama centered, and I don't think that Mandalorian is going to win, right? I think The Crown is probably going to be the
similar reason why I don't think Ratched is going to do very well,
right? Yeah, I think The Crown is just, it's more in line with what I think the people that usually end up picking these kinds of awards are tend to go with, just from historical, you know. I mean, I would love to be surprised, don't get me wrong, if they're give it to The Mandalorian, that would be like incredible, but that's probably not gonna happen. Yeah, now there is a final one that we haven't like talked about, right, which is the best picture.
Oh, best picture, that's gonna be Chicago 7,
right? I mean, look, that movie was really good. It just engaged from the very beginning to the very end. It was a great ride, and I definitely recommend people to see it, and that is obviously the topic of today's episode. This is a Netflix original series, so most likely you'll be able to catch this one. I know that There's been a couple movies that we've talked about in here that have been on HBO Max, and I know that not everybody has access to all of these other platforms, right? So I feel like with this being a Netflix original, it might be more accessible to more people versus the other ones that were also nominated in there that I believe not all of them are Netflix. I think maybe Chicago 7 was the only Netflix original, right?
Yeah, I think so, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know.
Jumping into the Trial of Chicago 7, let's just get down to it. Brass tacks, what did you think of Trial of the Chicago 7? Not 8, like they tried to make it.
You know, I think, first of all, I feel like they picked the right cast for this. Like, all of these actors really had amazing chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
They played off each other really well. They really brought another level that really made you believe and identify with these characters, which again, a lot of that had to do with the performance of all of these actors. And they picked some really good ones and some people that I have never seen before that I was really impressed.
For example, all these characters got so into their character and were so involved. My wife didn't even recognize Joseph Gordon-Levitt until she saw the cast listing when the credits rolled.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's another thing about Joseph Gordon-Levitt, right? That's at times can be surprising. I always forget, like, there's two actors that every time I watch them perform, I forget how good they really are. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt is one of them. The other one is Ryan Gosling. It's Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Ryan Gosling are the two actors that I'm always like, I forget how good you are.
I think the reason I always underestimate Joseph Gordon-Levitt is obviously you know him from his early days of acting, Third Rock from the Sun.
Yeah, exactly.
Which he started off very rough and kind of grew into the character over time because it was a series. He had that ability.
Mm-hmm.
Similar with his performance in 10 Things I Hate About You. He was decent in that, yeah. But it wasn't really a movie that challenged him as an actor.
No.
Since that's his base, that's where your mind always goes when you see he's in a movie.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he does way better than that. And you're like, oh yeah, right. He's a really good actor.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think obviously in Trial of the Chicago 7 or in drama series, obviously, is where I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt can spread his wings, so to speak, a little bit more efficiently because it just demands of it, right? Versus the other ones tend to be more mainstream and less drama. But this one, he just really transformed for sure. And Sacha Baron Cohen also is another one of those actors that you can see him transform into the character. Eddie Redmayne was a surprising one. I haven't really seen a film of Eddie Redmayne where he spoke in an American dialect.
Yeah.
So I think the first film I saw of Eddie Redmayne was the Fantastic Beasts movie. And obviously he doesn't speak with an American dialect. He speaks with his, you know, native British, right? Or English. So seeing him like with the American dialect was like on, like he did a good job with that.
That's another actor that just really goes all in and really kind of carries his performance, disappears into the role. You don't think of him as Redmayne, you think of him as his character in every performance he does. And solid actor choice on that part too.
For sure.
Another one that it was what, like 83% of lawyers polled say that the judge for this was hopefully incompetent. And the actor they got for that, he just, you know, hammed it up, chewed on the scenery when it was necessary, and just made you want to hate that judge so perfectly.
The judge is, what a performance of that, because I definitely was with you on the level of hatred that I got to the point where I'm like, oh my God, I hate him so much. I hate him so much. Like, he is the worst. Especially, I think, when we got surprise visit from Batman/the Vulture himself, which was a surprise to me
right.
when he showed up. I mean, we're talking obviously about Michael Keaton.
I was surprised to see Michael Keaton. He was there longer than what I would call a cameo, but
yes,
was definitely an unexpected appearance for sure. Actor of his caliber for that short piece that he did. And that was another one. He did it very well.
Yes.
He goes up and he does his testimony. The judge just unilaterally throws it out and like, oh, I don't see why this is material. Like, really? You don't see why this is material? And his response is like, don't try to fight it. Just get ready for your appeal. Oh my God. So many things that they can appeal this as a mistrial.
Yeah, exactly.
If there is any definition of a kangaroo court in the American justice system, it is this trial, which is why ultimately it was overturned as a mistrial in the appeals court, giving the Justice Department a chance to retry with a proper judge. And they're just like, yeah, no, we're not doing it.
Exactly. We're not doing it, which kind of showed just how ridiculous this was and why, you know, Abbie Hoffman, the character that was played by Sacha Baron Cohen, was continuously repeated through the movie, right? That this was a political trial, right? Like there were political ideals here on court, not exactly, you know, laws that were broken, which, you know, if you want to get technical, yeah, they kind of were broken, but not to the extent to where the punishment that they had intended for these people was basically deserved.
Well, even the way it opened up, he was like, the only thing they could really, really try him for was trespassing on federal property. And the guy was like, trump up some additional charges. You gotta make this a, you know, major trial. You gotta make this. And again, it was right from the start. It was all politically motivated because he didn't like how the previous administration handled their exit. So he's stuck trying to make his mark right from the beginning in order to compensate for that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think that was the basis, right? And that's what I liked about Abbie is that he was able to see through all of that, right? Him and his, I think it was Ruben, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were all like, yeah, this is what's happening here. Like, because they were even like saying like overruled, like together with the judge, because they knew what he was going to say. Because they knew that this wasn't like about whether or not they committed a crime and what the punishment for that crime should be. They knew that this was a darker statement. And that's what they like continuously made fun of it and thought that this whole thing was a circus, because it definitely what it was.
Right. And like they said, when someone was like, if you keep doing this, we're going to lose, or something along those lines. And their response was, our definition of winning is different from yours.
Right. Exactly.
They wanted to make sure that their political statement was heard. That is what they got out at the end.
Right. Absolutely. And that's the thing, right? Also, that they realized that they weren't going to win, right? They kind of saw that. They saw that a losing battle, if the goal was for them to basically say, hey, we don't believe that you should try us under this law.
Mm-hmm.
If that was the goal, Abbie and Ruben were like, well, we're going to lose that. That's an unwinnable battle. We know what the outcome of that's going to be. There's a greater point we need to make here.
Yeah.
And I like that they were very focused on that and how everyone else was basically on board with that. And I think that what I also liked is that the Richard Schultz, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, basically at the beginning of the movie was like, yeah, this is basically a nonsense trial. And throughout the whole movie, he really seemed extremely conflicted, right? Like, I always felt that conflicting points here because he didn't believe that this was fair, but his goal was to win because that's what he was hired to do. But I really enjoyed the performance of Joseph Gordon-Levitt because he, through his facial expressions, you can definitely see that conflict that he had throughout the entire trial.
It's one of those things, like, I know a lot of times when they make these based on a true story movies, they approach it with the lens of our modern society looking back at the events that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much real record they have of the sidebar with the judge between the prosecution, the defense, and the judge, but I really hope that the prosecution was there saying, yeah, you have crossed a unspeakable line here. You have to order his trial a mistrial and get him out of here.
Exactly.
I mean, the entire time that Bobby Seale was in that courtroom, they were violating his constitutional rights at every single moment.
Yeah.
Like, one thing that I really can't get is, okay, so the judge denied a stay to allow his lawyer to recover from gallbladder surgery to appear.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I didn't pick up on that was, after the trial had been going on for an extended period of time, why was his lawyer still not available?
Right, exactly. That didn't really make sense to me because it wasn't like the trial lasted for 20 days. The trial lasted for a lot longer than that. How many days was it, I think? Wasn't it like 100 and some days? Didn't it get past 100 or no?
Yeah, no, it went past 100, but I think it was into like the 3-month category when I think they finally got him to be mistried and get him removed from the seat. So it's like, I wish there was something more about that where there should have been a scene of some sort saying, oh, his lawyer is now available, and the judge still denying it or whatever. That was a missing piece for me. I needed to know why his lawyer wasn't eight. I know why his lawyer wasn't there for the start of the trial. I really want to know why his lawyer wasn't allowed in for the middle of the trial. That was a missing piece for me.
For sure. I totally hear you in that. And I am with you. Yeah, that was definitely a plot hole that I think was a little large.
I don't know if it's a plot hole, but it's a missing piece of information.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's an answer to it.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, they decided to skip it with the exposition of the movie, and it's missing.
You know what's interesting is that we have quite a few people in here that have been in superhero roles, and the Yahya Abdul-Mateen, who played Bobby Seale. You know, he's been in other superhero properties, right?
What else has he been in?
He was Manta in Aquaman.
Oh, man. I did not see that. That's right? Just the way these actors are just falling into these roles. Is like, even now that you say it, I can't picture the two of them side by side and thinking of them as the same person.
Yeah. He really became a whole different person for that. It was awesome. Because I didn't realize that until the end when I was like looking at all these actors, you know, and I was scrolling through them, and I'm like, when I clicked on his IMDb page and I'm like, Manta, what? That's like, I didn't even realize that. And so it's really shocking to see all of these folks. Now, we also have the actor who played the attorney, right? William Kunstler, Mark Rylance, who was in the Ready Player One film. And that's, I think, what he's most known for in more recent times, at least if you're, you know, in more nerdy terms.
Well, I'm going to disappoint you for something that my wife keeps getting mad at me. I have not seen Ready Player One yet.
What?
My wife keeps getting mad at me for it because she's seen it. What? She's read the book. I gave her Ready Player Two for Christmas, and she's like so on me for not seeing Ready Player One yet.
Settles it. Ready Player One is our next film.
All right.
This cannot be a thing. You cannot have gone this whole this time without watching that movie. It is one of my favorite movies. It is so much fun. I really enjoyed it. So yeah, we're talking about that next. Anyway, I could not disassociate that character from Ready Player One with William Kunstler on this. I had a real hard time with that. Like, really hard time. The whole time I'm like, that's the guy from Ready Player One. Yeah. Now, I want to talk about the director for a bit. Aaron Sorkin.
Okay.
This guy, you know, it seems like he's done this before several times. Pretty, you know, he's got a lot of history with films. And technically he does, but not as director. This is his third movie that he's directed. There is a couple other movies that he directed. Well, two movies that he's directed technically. Molly's Game was his first movie that he directed. And then Trial of Chicago 7 is his second one. And then there's one that is in pre-production called Being the Ricardos. And I guess he's coming back to direct again. But he has written for some other movies.
So I didn't see the first movie that he directed. So this is the first movie I've seen of him that he's directed. And he made a very good use of limited set design.
Yes.
I mean, his use of interspersing the one guy doing his stand-up comedic act in front of the college campus versus the same things being played out in real time back in the park during the protest and how it's being presented in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. His use of that switching back and forth created a very interesting sense of this was a very serious thing that was happened. These people are kind of making a little bit light of the situation because of how ridiculous that this happened at all. No matter how much the court wants to try and make it out to be a serious federal crime that they all committed that deserves this level of scrutiny, that ultimately the entire court itself was just a joke.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, I think that this is definitely a movie that is efficient when it comes to set pieces and set design. And the way that the story is also told is also in an efficient way. There weren't really a whole lot of scenes that I felt like I could get up now and do something because this is not as engaging throughout this whole movie. I felt like every single scene nailed it when it came to the pacing of it and how important it was to get to the next thing, but in a way that, you know, kind of built from the scene before. And yeah, the set pieces were really great. Everything seemed incredibly real to me, the courtroom and all of that stuff. I liked the little details, for example, like using the tables and chairs that they had looked used, for example, mm-hmm. right? And that like created this sense of realism, right? That they weren't sitting in this pristine courtroom. It looked like a real courtroom. I like that. And I like all of those small little details on that. And it's interesting because, you know, Aaron Sorkin has actually directed other movies that have to deal with trials or political dramas. And one of those being A Few Good Men.
Yeah.
Aaron Sorkin was a writer for A Few Good Men, and he also wrote several episodes for The West Wing.
One of the things I did like about how he portrayed the courtroom in this one is he did keep a little bit more true to how courtrooms work, where the lawyers will speak from behind their desks, but they still break it a little bit with having them going into the well, walking up to address the jury, walking up to address the witness. It's like, no, you're not allowed to do that.
Well, I mean, this was 1960s, you know, maybe.
No, even in the 60s, you are not allowed in the well of a courtroom without expressly asking the judge for permission first.
Right.
It's usually for a very specific reason.
Yeah. No, and that's, you're right. I mean, this is part where Hollywood courtrooms are far more engaging and interesting versus the real courtrooms can be a little dull if you have to like ask permissions. And like, it doesn't flow well in the scene. I mean, you can add it, but you know, this is the part where I feel like to remind people, this is Hollywood. In real life, you have to ask this. Otherwise, as you mentioned in a previous episode, you get tackled.
Right? Oh, geez. Now, something I want to kind of jump on that. With a lot of based on true story movies, They often do that thing where at the end of the movie, they start giving these little heads up of this is what happened to these people after this trial was over.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wish they skipped that a little bit because aside from the fact that their case was appealed and the Justice Department decided not to retry it, I really kind of wish that was all they gave us because some of these people ended up having some depressing and unfortunate endings.
Yeah, I know. That was some real hard stuff, especially for Abby, I think, was probably the one that I like felt the most.
Yeah.
You know, just because I thought, oh man, that's really depressing. Oh, you know, like, so I hear you on that. I think you said something similar for Ford versus Ferrari, now that I think about it. You know, yeah. You were like, couldn't we just like not see that whole death scene at the end? You know, well, there wasn't a death scene, but it was like that whole, really, that was really the way that they ended the film wasn't like.
See, this one, at least they just said that these depressing things happened to a number of them. Ford versus Ferrari was worse because they actually like, here's our high. Oh, now we're going to carry on it for a few more scenes and just drop it right down into the bottom of the pits. It's just like, no, stop on the high.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you on that. Like the way to end some of these films that are obviously in real life, these people have some that their lives were ended in a tragedy, right? It's a little difficult to sort of not honor that in these movies, right? And I think that that's why it's important to sort of show that what happens to some of these people, because, you know, these are real people that really lived, right? And really did go through this trial in real life, obviously not exactly like it is in the movie, but a lot of this stuff was based on that, right? And so I think representing that and informing the people of what happened to this man who went through all of this stuff is important. I just think that it's,
I mean, ultimately it's being true to who they are and who they became. And I mean, it wasn't all sad. I mean, the one became a senator that was reelected, what, 6 times it said?
Yeah, I think that was Tom Hayden.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not a terrible way to end the movie, but it was a little bit of a downer. It's like, I do like ending movies on a positive note, especially ones that are highlighting a lot of the injustices that people have had to face in order to get the country to where it is just today. Because you know that our country is not perfect. We still have things that we can make better. But it's also important to understand the struggles that people had to face. And when you're focusing on those struggles, I do enjoy it coming out as a high point of victory of we are a better country because of things that they did.
Right. I totally hear you on that. I think a message of positivity, I think, is important in some of these movies, right, to see so that we can just have a better outlook to the future in general, you know, and be more inspired rather than like bummed out. Well, with that, Nathan, should we jump into our TLDL?
Too long, didn't listen.
All right. And this is a section where we give you our thoughts on our movie or TV shows that we're reviewing here. So Trial of the Chicago 7, TLDL, Nathan.
Overall, this had a rather good collection of very good actors who immediately fall into their roles. They disappear into the characters, and you're not even thinking about where you've seen these actors before. You are just thinking about who they are in this moment. And that accomplishes a great performance of telling us a lot of the heartache and trials and tribulations we have had in our past, from social injustice to racism to just politically motivated theater on both sides of the aisle, that is kind of a good, important lesson to be demonstrating and to remember and not to have forgotten. And for that reason, I think this is a very much must-see film, especially for anyone of the younger generation that didn't live in that time. I really do think that this is going to take the Golden Globe for Best Motion Picture.
Absolutely. I'm definitely with you here. The Trial of the Chicago 7, if anything, this is absolutely a film to watch for the performances alone. I think that the performances of all of these people are just absolutely amazing. The pacing of this movie is also really, really good. I've said it before. I keep mentioning pacing in every episode almost, because that, to me, like, pacing is so crucial and so important to keeping me engaged. And I think that Aaron Sorkin did a great job of both directing and writing this movie. I am actually looking forward to more Aaron Sorkin stuff that he's directing. Yeah, I think that the message of this film was really, really inspiring and great. I agree with you. I think this is a movie, especially for the younger generation. Like, I didn't really know much about the trial of the Chicago 7, and I've learned so much about it, you know, since this movie came out. And it's just crazy how many parallels you see back then to today. And hopefully, you know, we'll work on that, and so we don't get to see these parallels of like previous times. But overall, I definitely recommend this movie. It's an absolute treat. Definitely check it out. Again, it's a Netflix original series, so it should be more accessible to most people.
And with that, Dan, final thought. We are obviously not past social injustice and social politically motivated events playing out in today's day. And there are definitely some trials and some issues going on today that people are going to need to learn more about in the next generation. Is there anything in particular that you really see going on now that is going to become the trial of the Chicago 7 sort of movie for my kids and my grandkids?
Oh man, that's a really good question. And the reason for that is because I feel like in the last 4 years, there's so many that I think could be that, right? But I can't really think of anything. But hey, if you all can think of something, an event in the last 4 years, for example, that is going to be turning to a film like The Trial of the Chicago 7, definitely let us know. Hitting us up on Facebook at
Streaming Thoughts and on Twitter at
Streaming Geek.
This has been Nathan.
And this has been Daniel.
Thank you for listening.